Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 or email your questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. Dr. John Robinson, who is a scientist with a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and that's the one in America. I've got a local Manukau Institute of Technology that I went to, which we refer to as MIT as well, but this is the real MIT. And Dr. Robinson has written a series of books on early New Zealand history and also on cultural and political developments in the present day. And his most recent book, Who Really Broke the Treaty, was published by Tross Publishing. And he joins us now to discuss this very topical issue. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi there.
And have you got any other background you'd like to give us on your history, your interest in the subject, how you sort of got onto writing about the treaty and other early parts of New Zealand history?
Yes, my background has quite a relevance here, I think. As a research scientist, we often come across problems where you don't know what's going on, and that's because the accepted theory just doesn't fit the facts. And then it becomes important to reach outside the accepted theory, what you're told to believe, and you have to ask questions. Now, that came up in also in the second lot of work I did in futures research, which was looking at the long-term future of the Earth. And there you gathered a huge number of facts until you're so confused it's not funny. And what was important there was to stand back and see the broad picture. So that became very important. And that enters into the further bit of work I did on social statistics for a decade or so, looking at the difference between Maori and non-Maori, and coming to the realisation that we were not measuring and discussing ethnicity. We were looking at class differences. And that was very, very clear in 1984, because after the move of Maori into the cities, just after the Second World War, conditions improved for many Maori. The difference in life expectancy, Maori and non-Maori, had been 20 years in 1940. And it had dropped steadily down to be 5 years in 1984. And that would have disappeared by the year 2000. There'd be no difference by now if that trend had kept on. But the trend was broken by the immediate huge change in government policy under Rogernomics, which introduced an underclass and increased inequalities tremendously. And the Maori, who'd become largely members of the working class, suffered, and that difference in life expectancy went from that 5 years up to 9 years and settled down to about seven. So what is clear is that a lot of the problems that are there today are due to political decisions, nothing to do with colonisation. By the way, so I've followed that sort of trend of being free to think for myself, and that brings about conclusions which are considered controversial. And in today's world, you're not allowed to be controversial or ask questions. So I don't fit in very well.
I can understand that. We have that at Reality Check Radio. We're all people who don't fit in to the accepted narrative and like to ask questions. It's interesting you mentioned what you thought was a class issue, not an ethnic issue. And I was just thinking about the fact that our government has now, the largest number of ministers of Maori descent. But they're all, very well off. It's interesting to see, that distinction has occurred. And it's largely a class-based distinction between what you see in the Labour Party Māori caucus, what you see in the Māori Party, very much poorer working class, as you mentioned, and then the support and ministers that are of Māori descent in the government, more well-off, affluent people. So it's not really an ethnic problem, as you say.
And the leadership in the who in the Māori group, since we are talking race, because race is very important to New Zealand, not to me, but to New Zealand, they're mostly the well-off Māori who've, the Māori elite, as it's referred to often, who've got a great deal out of treaty settlements and jobs for the boys and so on. Can I get on to where the treaty comes in here? Because all my work on statistics, there was no mention of the treaty ever in any of that. But I came across that around 2000 when some of my work was for the Crown Forestry Rental Trust. And I was suggesting that the Māori had not suffered terribly from the wrongs of colonialism, but had benefited considerably. And I'd simply had to rewrite it. So I had to find out what was this treaty business that was directing all the research and meant that I couldn't take part in it. I was told I couldn't understand Māori, and particularly the old Māori, and I decided to test that one by trying to understand Tamati Wakanini, a killing chief, you know, a warrior, who became a friend of government and a peacemaker and so on, as was Te Wharewha, the first Māori king. So I found, yes, we can understand one another. They're all real people, just like us. And by taking that sort of stance, I've become one of the people who've been labelled as racist. So I asked myself, okay, what are you talking about? What is racist? I'm calling for equality. Well, I've got a simple definition of racism, which is, first of all, to believe in race. Now, a Māori in New Zealand law is a member of the New Zealand race, so that's the first thing to establish, that race is written into New Zealand law. Second step, to measure people by race, to divide them, and that's carried out in New Zealand all the time, separate parties, separate seats, and so on. And thirdly, to give different treatment to different races, and that's carried out in New Zealand. So there's my definition of racism, by which definition New Zealand is racist.
And yeah, that's a very interesting way to put it. And so what was it that really got you to write this book, Who Really Broke the Treaty, and other books that you've written covering the treaty? And what's the thesis of the book? What's it really about in a short summary?
Well, the next step was to ask the forbidden question, who really broke the treaty? Because we're told, and the Waitangi Tribunal was set up to establish this, that the Crown and the Crown alone broke the treaty against the Māori. So I decided to take an independent look at it and just say, okay, what is it to break the treaty? Who is it that might have broke the treaty? And to have a good look at that.
And so what are the actual obligations then that the Treaty of Waitangi put on each side in 1840?
Well, the first point is all people involved in the treaty took on obligations. That, of course, includes the Māori who signed the treaty. They said, we'll stick to this. Now, most Māori welcomed the treaty. In fact, that was shown quite dramatically at Waitangi. On the Wednesday, the treaty was presented. The treaty, by the way, was written by English, by the British, was translated into Māori by the British. So you can't write the British out of the consideration of what the treaty is and what it means. But that was on the Wednesday. And on the Thursday, Hobson thought he'd have a day off and they'd come back on the Friday and go on for a week or so of discussion. But Friday morning, the chiefs turned up and said, we want to sign the treaty. So we've got to understand the treaty was desired by Māori. They wanted it. It was part of a huge Māori cultural transformation that went from probably 1830 to 1850, where Maori moved from tribal warfare, cannibalism, female infanticide and slavery to a British system of justice. So it was a huge change where they moved from their tikanga, and the chiefs on that day showed how keen they were to sign that treaty, and that attitude was shown in further discussions amongst Maori, who were very welcoming of both the coming of law and the coming of Christianity. As a non-Christian, I can see the benefit that Christianity brought to the Maori at that time. And above all, it gave a picture of all people as having some equality across the world.
And a very key element here as well with the missionaries is that they were invited to come by the Maori, by the chiefs, to set up mission stations, to set up schools from the, especially during the 1820s and 30s, I believe. They did a lot of work up and down the North Island, and you know, they were heavily involved as well in encouraging the Treaty of Waitangi as being something that would be have a very positive impact on Maori, who were trapped in this cycle of warfare, of utu, that would go on. And the missionaries worked very, very hard to break that. And they made a lot of progress, you know, because many Maori themselves desired that. You know, they were sick of this.
There's so many people to admire in our history. Our history is presented today as one of wrongs and wrongdoing and so on. There were great people doing fantastic things. And this was the meeting of two very different people. The Maori had come across the Pacific over 3,000 years. So for 3,000 years, Polynesians had been separated from the vast mass of humanity across the Eurasian landmass. And during the time that the city-state had developed and philosophies and so on, they were quite separated. Yet they got together, they discussed. Not only were Maori prepared to sit down and talk to Maori, Maori talked to the missionaries too. So it was a great exchange.
Something I found on reading more about early New Zealand history as well as how intelligent that the Maori were considered, how quickly they learned things, how quickly they adapted, and they worked very well side by side with the missionaries. And in the end, after the treaty was signed, then the obligations, and that, you know, we need to talk a little bit more about, because how were these obligations broken then? You've asked who really broke the treaty. Well, you know, who were the first ones to kind of start to realize that, you know, they didn't really want to put up with their side of the deal?
Well, first of all, the treaty gave the right to govern, and British law prevailed thereafter, made so very clear by Aparana Nata writing about the Maori treaty in 1922. So the treaty involved simply setting up a system and a structure by which decisions and judgments would be made by the proper authorities. So it was no longer by chiefly might, not just the chief could decide, I don't like you, bang, you're dead type of thing. So we've got a couple of points. All parties had signed up to that and could be considered to have broken it. And secondly, and this is particularly important, should the new authority make a judgment that we don't like today, that wasn't to break the treaty. We can't sit in judgment. They were dealing with a difficult situation, and to break the treaty is simply to move outside of a proper way of governing, not to be perfect in every decision. So shall I move on to a few representative examples of breaking of the treaty? Because that was the next step I had to take. Who broke the treaty? Now, I dealt with it rather briefly in the book, about seven examples, giving an idea. You could do a huge tomes on that if you want, if you set up a Waitangi tribunal to look at all breaches of the treaty. But that hasn't been done. And here's just three of them. First of all, the Wairau massacre of 1843, when Te Rapa and Rangi Hayata killed 11 defenceless prisoners. Now, the original fighting was as much the blame of the settlers and the British as of the Maori. They got into fight, but because the Maori were still coming out of tribalism, their fighting was pretty brutal. They took prisoners and killed 11 who were then defenceless. Now, that killing was a breach of the treaty. It was against the law, it was a breach of the treaty. Now, Fitzroy decided not to punish them. Now, in my judgment, Fitzroy did a terrible wrong, but he was not breaking the treaty because he was given that authority. That's what the treaty set up, that authority. Now, a second example is what happened in North Taranaki in 1859 and 1860, because we go back in the history. In the 1820s, the Taranaki people had been driven out of their lands by the Waikato, killed. Some were taken prisoner as slaves back to Waikato. Some escaped and came down to where I am now, in Kapiti, and killed the people living here, drove them out, took their land. You can see how war leads to war all the time. But however, after the peace had been made, they were able to move back home. And the people from Waikanae took with them some feuds. They were very argumentative people. And in particular, some wanted to sell some land and some said, you're not going to do that. So the feuds had killed about 50 people and it was lawlessness across northern Taranaki. So the governor, Gore Brown, went there in 1859 and said, okay, it's time to bring law to this area, to bring peace. And immediately some of them said, does that mean we can sell our land? And he had to say yes, and they showed that they owned the land, and so it was sold, and immediately the king, the chief, the main chief, Kingi, he decided he wouldn't allow that, so he set up a fort, and so war started. That was rebellion, and that was a breach of the treaty by Kingi. You'll notice that the British were trying very hard to see both sides of questions and settle things as best they could. That's what the rule of law is about. A third example is that in 1857 and 1858, the big meetings in the Waikato to suggest setting up a king. Most Waikato Maori refused. That is not well known, but most Maori in the Waikato said, no, we don't want your king. Your king says we can't sell our land. He's going to bully us and tell us what we can and can't do. And we're quite satisfied with the government we've got now. So the Kingites went away and appointed poor old Te Whirawhira. He was in the last year and a half of his life, an old man, and pretended he was a king. And that led on to war. The setting up of a rival monarch and a rival territory was definitely a breach of the treaty. It was treason, and that was properly punished, and there was nothing wrong with confiscating some land as a result of rebellion. So we have several examples there in which the people who broke the treaty were Maori. And the people who suffered were the settlers who were moved out of the areas in northern Taranaki, for example, Waitara, where the settlers had been told, yes, you can settle here, and they'd been moved. That happened on two occasions. So there was a lot of suffering. And so here's my conclusion. The Crown, the civil governors, and the government never broke the Treaty of Waitangi. All actions taken were in accord with the accession of sovereignty and the assertion of British law. And to repeat again, that didn't guarantee that the decisions would be completely what are satisfactory to today's Maori Party. And a number of Maori chiefs and their iwi committed acts of treason and rebellion in contradiction to Tricky Whiting. So that's the challenge I'm making. That's my analysis.
And your analysis is completely at odds with modern academia. So why is it then that only the Crown is deemed capable of treaty breaches by modern lawyers and academics?
Because that's the way it was set up in 1975 under the insistence of Matt Rata, a member of the Labour government at the time. And so that was to consider only claims of wrongdoing by the Crown against Maori, as you've said. His aim became pretty clear because he wanted more and more and more, and he then got dissatisfied with the Labour government, wouldn't give him all he wanted, and he left and set up his own party, Mana Motuhake, which wanted to have a separate government, which is a similar to the It's an echo of a bill for kotahitanga brought before Parliament by Honeheke Napua in 1894. These ideas have been around amongst the minority of Maori and have been turned down time and time again. And the process that has now been set up is worth having a look at because we have, first of all, the Treaty of Waitangi is labelled as a sacred document. We have to follow it. We can't change a word of it. And the meaning of it can only be defined by current Maori leadership. It's as if the British, the English, all the rest of us are written out of that. And that is a naked power grab. It's a weapon or taking over much of the government. And you can see that in the description of the prescription in Hei Puapua, a report, I've written a book on that, a report to government which suggests that we must head by 2030. Sorry, I've got that. It was 2040. 2040, their vision 2040, towards two separate governments, two separate sets of laws. Complete institutional apartheid is what is proposed in an end to democracy and equality. That's the did you think I'm saying something a bit extreme? Because I'm quoting from documents. I'm quoting from Hei Puapua. I'm not just making it up. I'm quoting from a Te Kei Mai and other reports. If you listen to what is being said, that is the aim now.
I've read those government reports, and definitely this is not something you're making up. Everyone who's read those reports knows that that's what's in them. There are some conservatives even who perhaps say, look, the second article of the treaty especially sort of seems to guarantee some kind of lower level of authority and territorial integrity to Maori that maybe wasn't upheld. Do you have a response to that, to say that the treaty perhaps it could rightly be interpreted as allowing some kind of perhaps like devolved powers, local powers of local government over their territories to Maori? Is there something like that that you see as a fair argument, or is that just, again, a modern mind's reading into the treaty, something that was never there?
If you follow it a bit, you'll see that the meaning of words has changed over time, so that the property was defined as property taken at the point of a spear by Hongihika back in the 1820s, and it's now become treasures. It's been anything and everything. You can see the point there I'm making, that the only people who are now allowed to interpret the treaty are the separatists. You see, that is their claim. That must be refuted. And the three parts of the treaty, first of all sovereignty goes to the Crown. And at the moment, it has been ruled in the Supreme Court and by the Waitangi Tribunal that the sovereignty is in the hands of iwi and hapu, so that is a contrary to the treaty completely. And the third is that we're all equal, we're all British. And the second one is perhaps a little unclear, but it was challenged once by the British, who claimed terra nullius, and that is not made clear in the second article, which land remains in Maori control. But the argument there was settled in favour of Maori. All unsettled land belongs to Maori. So I guess that comes to your next question, which was, what relevance should the treaty have today? Which is kind of important, and my answer is very simple, none. None whatsoever. The treaty has been stripped of all meaning. It's now claimed that it means the opposite to the original. It's used as a weapon for dividing us. So it should be set aside. And there's a far more important question to consider. What sort of society do we today want here in New Zealand today?
And that society is full of many different kinds of people. I guess we have a very multicultural society today, whether we like it or not. And the situation before us is basically one of, do we have effectively two different classes of people in New Zealand, or do we have a single united society with one law that governs all of us together?
That's my point, yes. Well put.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And we are nearly out of time here, so I just wanted to ask you if you've got other books that you've written that you might want to mention or recommend. I could already say the Tross Publishing. If you go through to the website, trosspublishing.com, there's a long list of books that you've written there. Are there any in particular that you might want to recommend to people?
Well, I will leap in with a couple. Hey, Poor Poor, it's basic. Everybody should read that and should have read the Hey, Poor Poor report. I've written a book early on in the New Zealand experience just describing the meeting of two very different people, because Maori and non-Maori were very different back then in 1800 and so on. And thirdly, the Kingite Rebellion. And I mention that because it's a thick book that looks at all the background to the King movement and the rebellion then, and carrying it towards today.
Well, thank you for that. And that was Dr. John Robinson, who has written a series of books on early New Zealand history. Thank you very much for joining us. And to the audience, we will be right back after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to, or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.